This is the Sunday Catholic Word, a production of Catholic Answers, the only podcast to look at the Sunday Mass readings from an apologetics perspective.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Sunday Catholic Word, a podcast where we reflect on the upcoming Sunday Mass readings and pick out the details that are relevant for explaining and defending our Catholic faith. I'm Carlo Broussard, staff apologist and speaker for Catholic Answers and the host for this podcast. In this episode, we're going to focus on three details for this upcoming Sunday Mass readings. Two of the details come from the first reading, taken from Wisdom chapter 1, verses 13 through 15, and chapter 2, verses 23 through 24. And both have to do with theological questions concerning death, particularly God's causal relation to it and death's relation to the fall of Adam. The third detail is Jesus' raising of Jairus' daughter in the gospel reading, taken from Mark chapter 5, verses 21 through 24, and 35b through 43, which is the shorter version of the gospel that leaves out the story of the hemorrhaging woman. We're going to look at the raising of Jairus' daughter as a story and whether it's reliable or not, historically speaking. So let's start with the first reading, taken from Wisdom 1, 13 through 15, and chapter 2, verses 23 through 24. Here's what we read. God did not make death, nor does he rejoice in the destruction of the living, for he fashioned all things that they might have being, and the creatures of the world are wholesome, and there is not a destructive drug among them, nor any domain of the netherworld on earth, for justice is undying. For God formed man to be imperishable, the image of his own nature he made him. But by the envy of the devil death entered the world, and they who belong to his company experience it. The first detail I want to focus on is the statement, God did not make death, nor does he rejoice in the destruction of the living. There are two questions that this verse gives rise to. The first is this, if God didn't make death, then how do we explain God's making of material creatures, which are subject to corruption and death? There seems to be an incompatibility between these two beliefs. In response, the problem only arises if we assume death is some thing, like a substance that God makes. But death is not some substance that has being. Rather, death is a privation of what ought to be there in the nature of the thing, namely, the union of its body and soul. Death, therefore, doesn't fall within the purview of divine causality, which gives being, since there's no being to be given in death. When a thing physically exists, God is giving being to the physical substance, which involves the union of its body and soul. But when death occurs, the metaphysical reality is that God, for whatever reason, in his providence, ceases to give being to the physical union, resulting in the disunity of the body and the soul, i.e. death. In the case of humans, we know the soul continues to live on with that being that God initially gave, but death nevertheless does occur. For non-rational animals, the being of that union would cease to exist completely to where the individual in and of itself completely would cease to exist. So it's true to say God did not make death, even though the material beings that he does make are subject to death insofar as they are material creatures. Death is not something that God creates. And this is how we can reconcile, logically, that although death considered an evil of itself is not something that is quote-unquote created by God, because it's more of a privation of what ought to be there rather than something. Now, the second question that arises is this. How can we say that God doesn't rejoice in the destruction of the living when throughout the Bible, God positively wills the death of human beings? You might include as examples the Old Testament. You might include here Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5. And so some might appeal to this and see this as incompatible with what the Book of Wisdom is saying here. Now, the answer to this question is going to depend on whether death is willed by punishment or not. There are two different ways to answer this, similar, related, but different. In situations where death is willed as punishment, death of itself is not that which terminates or completes God's willing. In other words, he's not delighting in the death itself. nor does God delight in the punishment itself, whenever that death takes on the form of punishment, since punishment in these cases is the death of the sinner. Rather, God delights in the justice that such lethal punishments takes on the form of justice. And that justice simply is a manifestation of God's divine wisdom, which just is his own goodness. So God's willing of lethal punishment in proportion to the gravity of certain sins is just a willing of his own goodness. He rejoices in his own goodness, not the death itself. Now, in situations where there is an innocent person involved and the death doesn't take on the form of punishment, we have a bit of a more difficult situation, right? A little bit harder to see how it's not contrary to God's goodness or justice, although not insolvable. Consider, first of all, that God doesn't owe the preservation of physical life to any material creature. The corruption and death of physical beings is part and parcel of physical beings. This being the case, God's preservation of the life of physical beings is something over and above their nature. Since God doesn't owe what is over and above our nature, or the nature of physical beings, it follows that he doesn't owe us or any physical being the preservation of physical life. His willing the death of a physical being, therefore, is simply consistent with that thing's nature. So, at least so far, we can see that God willing the death of an innocent human being is not contrary to his justice. Again, God doesn't owe the preservation of the physical life of the innocent human being or any physical creature. Now, but this raises the question, well, how is this not a rejoicing in death? Well, like in our explanation for punishment, in these situations where God wills the death of an innocent person, that event willed wouldn't terminate or complete God's willing, because such an event would necessarily be ordered somehow to the good of the whole providential plan, which just is a manifestation of the divine goodness. That's to say, God's will would not terminate in the death of the innocent human being. Rather, God's will would be complete and terminating in his own goodness. This being the case, God's willing the death of an innocent human person ultimately would be simply a willing of his own goodness, like it is the case in his willing of anything else that's part and parcel of his providential plan, ultimately ordered toward the manifestation of his goodness, and thereby when God wills certain things to happen within this created order, he's willing his own goodness. Things are willed on account of his own goodness, to manifest his own goodness. Now, it's true that we might not know what the specific good relative to the whole providential plan is, and that's okay. We should expect to not know some things that pertain to God's providential plan, but we can know that there is a good that God orders it to, and that's all we need, apologetically speaking. God can order that willed death of an innocent human being to that greater good. And thus, it in no way conflict with God's goodness. Again, the key there is understanding that God is not bound to himself or to us to preserve us in that physical life. And so by willing the death of an innocent human person, he would be willing that which is consistent with the nature of the thing, thereby not violating the nature of the thing, and then also ultimately ordering it to some good. And given what we know about the immortality of the soul and the omnipotence of God, and especially in light of Christian revelation, God can compensate that death for the individual himself in the afterlife. Consider this. Given that God is omnipotent, there is no good that God could not possibly order the willed death toward in order to compensate and make up for that death. So, now, the second detail worth highlighting in this first reading is chapter 2, verse 24 of Wisdom. But by the envy of the devil, death entered the world, and they who belong to his company experience it. The question that arises here is, how do we reconcile this statement with what science tells us concerning the millions of years of the death of animals before Adam and Eve ever existed? There seems to be an incompatibility here between wisdom saying death enters the world through the envy of the devil and death existing before Adam and Eve, assuming that we're talking about the envy of the devil leading to the sin of Adam in the garden. The key is that death here refers to human death. The context bears this out. The immediately preceding verse, verse 23 of chapter 2, reads, quote, "For God formed man to be imperishable. The image of his own nature he made him," close quote. The author then contrasts this truth with death entering the world through the envy of the devil. The implication is that the devil's envy caused death for man. Also, notice how the author states afterward, quote, "They who belong to the devil's company experience death." By they, the author is referring to the humans. So the author is focusing specifically on human death, not death generally speaking that would apply to both plants and animals prior to humans. And this interpretation maps on with what the Catechism of the Catholic Church teaches in paragraph 400. It states this: "The harmony in which they had found themselves, that is Adam and Eve, thanks to original justice, is now destroyed with the fall. The control of the soul's spiritual faculties over the body is shattered. The union of man and woman becomes subject to tensions, their relations henceforth marked by lust and domination. Harmony with creation is broken. Visible creation has become alien and hostile to man. Because of man, creation is now subject to its own bondage to decay. Finally, the consequence explicitly foretold for this disobedience will come true. Man will return to the ground, for out of it he was taken." And here's the money quote: "Death makes its entrance into human history," so the Catechism says. And it's emphasized there. It's italicized. So the emphasis is in the original here. The Catechism elsewhere states in paragraph 376, quote, "As long as Adam remained in divine intimacy, man would not have to suffer or die," close quote. And this fits with wisdom's teaching, "For God formed man to be imperishable." The original, quote-unquote, intention was for man to remain free from death on condition that he obeyed God's command. But that condition was not met, and so thereby Adam forfeited for himself and for the human race the divine gift of preservation from death. But again, that's a gift. As preservation from physical death is not something owed to the human race. It was a gift that was going to be given to the human race on condition that the head of the human race obeyed God. But he didn't obey, and so that gift is withheld. And so death, in that sense, takes on a penal or punishment dimension to it. But in and of itself, death is something that our corporeal natures are naturally ordered to. So wisdom's teaching about death entering into the world doesn't conflict with what science tells us about the death of animals and plants before the fall of Adam and Eve. Okay, so let's now move to Jesus' raising of Jairus' daughter in the gospel reading. This account is taken again from Mark chapter 5, verses 21 through 24, and 35b through 43. I'm going to go ahead and read the whole report here. "When Jesus had crossed again into the boat to the other side, a large crowd gathered around him, and he stayed close to the sea. One of the synagogue officials, named Jairus, came forward. Seeing him, he fell at his feet and pleaded earnestly with him, saying, 'My daughter is at the point of death. Please come lay your hands on her, that she may get well and live.' He went off with him, and a large crowd followed him and pressed upon him. While he was still speaking, people from the synagogue official's house arrived and said, 'Your daughter has died. Why trouble the teacher any longer?' Disregarding the message that was reported, Jesus said to the synagogue official, 'Do not be afraid, just have faith.' He did not allow anyone to accompany him inside except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. When they arrived at the house of the synagogue official, he caught sight of a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. So he went in and said to them, 'Why this commotion and weeping? The child is not dead, but asleep.' And they ridiculed him. And then he put them all out. He took along the child's father and mother and those who were with him and entered the room where the child was. He took the child by the hand and said to her, 'Talitha cum,' which means, 'Little girl, I say to you, arise.' The girl, a child of 12, arose immediately and walked around. At that, they were utterly astounded. He gave strict orders not that no one should know this and said that she should be given something to eat." Now, what I want to focus on here are the elements that support the historical reliability of the story. And I'm going to look to John P. Meyer for some help. In volume 2 of his work, A Marginal Jew, he gives 5 reasons to think this narrative is historical. First, the high status of Jairus as a synagogue official within the region of Galilee makes the event checkable. It's not like this miracle is being performed for some Joe in a back alley that no one ever heard of. Identifying Jairus as a synagogue official serves another reason for this narrative's historicity. It's unlikely that Christians would have added this name to the oral tradition prior to the Markan narrative because Christians weren't sympathetic to the synagogue leaders. The synagogues and their leaders banned the early Christians from their communities, putting them on Rome's radar for persecution. So it's apologetically unappealing to add an individual from a group that was hostile to the early Christians. This is perhaps why Matthew doesn't even mention Jairus' name and reduces him to a mere ruler in Matthew chapter 9, verse 18. Since including the name of a synagogue ruler would run contrary to any apologetic purposes that Mark might have had, yet he still includes him, it's reasonable to conclude that it's true. A third reason for this event's historicity is that it meets the criterion of embarrassment. Notice that when Jesus told the mourners that the little girl was sleeping, they laughed at him, and Jesus put them all outside there in verse 40. People laughing at and scorning Jesus would have left a bitter taste in the mouth of the early Christians. If the early Christians were concerned with truth, they wouldn't have added this to the oral tradition. And furthermore, it's a bit of an embarrassment to portray Jesus as giving the boot to grieving people, right? Kind of makes Jesus seem to be a bit mean there. Therefore, it's reasonable to conclude that this event was a part of the primitive tradition that Mark is drawing on, and that it dates back to the time of Jesus' ministry. The story also contains unique Semitisms, which for scholars, like the embarrassment criterion, give reason to think that the narrative has its origin within a Palestinian community near the time of Jesus and is historical. And the closer a narrative is to the events it narrates, the more reliable it is. Meyer gives several here, Semitisms that is, but one in particular is Jesus' statement, Talitha kum, which is Aramaic for a little girl, I say to you, rise. That Mark preserves the phrase in its Aramaic form and doesn't translate it into Greek suggests an authentic primitive tradition. Not only is this phrase significant because it's in Aramaic, but as Father Robert Spitzer points out in his book, God So Loved the World, it's in popular Aramaic as opposed to formal or written Aramaic, which would have been Talitha kumi. This would be akin to my saying y'all versus you all, or that ain't gonna happen versus that will not happen. Why would Mark preserve Talitha kum if it's an incorrect way of speaking? Perhaps because he was trying to preserve the expression as it came from the lips of Jesus himself. I can imagine that if I were giving a talk that was being transcribed, the transcriber wouldn't change my Southern Cajun expressions to proper English because such expressions identify me as a Southerner. Similarly, it's likely that Mark doesn't correct Jesus' improper mode of speech because he's trying to preserve the expression as it came from Jesus. The late Jewish scholar Geza Vermes reaches a similar conclusion in his book, The Changing Faces of Jesus. He writes this, "It may also be presumed that like Peter, whose northern identity betrayed his speech," and we have several references for that, one of which is Matthew 26:73. "Jesus also spoke the Galilean dialect of Aramaic. His commanded address to the dead daughter of Jairus is reproduced as Talitha kum, little girl, or literally little lamb, get up, and the Otis codices of Mark 5:41. But kum represents Galilean slovenly speech in joining the masculine form of the imperative to a feminine subject, as against the grammatically correct kumi, which we find in some of the more recent and polished manuscripts of the gospel." So, Talitha kum is a Semitism, thereby showing a very, very early tradition that Mark is drawing on, even coming from the lips of Jesus himself. And thus, it's reliable. Finally, it's worth noting the absence of Christological titles in the narrative. This would have been a perfect opportunity to highlight Jesus' divinity with a post-resurrection title like Lord, given that he's manifesting his power over life and death. So Meyer argues. But Mark, Matthew, and Luke all refer Jesus to Jesus only as teacher in their accounts of raising Jairus' daughter. Luke does up the ante a bit with master, Greek epistates, in his account of Jesus healing the hemorrhaging woman there in Luke 8:46, but even that falls short of the divine title, Lord. So that Jesus raised the dead is something we can trust because the record of such a deed is historically reliable, at least in this case, the raising of Jairus' daughter. Jesus rose two others in the Gospels, and we would have to investigate those to show that certain criteria are met for the historical reliability of those reports, but that is something for another time. And as long as the skeptic is not ahistorical and allows historical testimony as valid evidence for a miracle having occurred, well, then Jesus' raising of Jairus' daughter provides such a skeptic with the type of miracle that can rationally justify belief, not just in the existence of God, but in Jesus' divinity. Well, my friends, that does it for this episode of the Sunday Catholic Word, the first reading and the gospel reading for this upcoming 13th Sunday of Ordinary Time. Year B, don't sell us short when it comes to material for apologetical discussions. We have God's causal relation to death and his goodness, the reconciliation of the scientific narrative of history and the biblical narrative, and the historicity of Jesus' raising of Jairus' daughter, which provides rational grounds for belief in the divinity of Jesus. So that's definitely a treasure chest for apologetical studies. As always, thank you for subscribing to the podcast. Please be sure to tell your friends about it and invite them to subscribe as well at SundayCatholicWord.com. You might also want to check out the other great podcasts in our Catholic Answers Podcast Network if you haven't done so already. Cy Keller's Catholic Answers Focus, Trent Horn's The Council of Trent, Joe Heschmeyer's Shameless Popery, and Jimmy Akin's A Daily Defense, all of which can be found at Catholic.com. And if you're interested in getting some cool mugs and stickers with my logo, Mr. Sunday Podcast, you can go to shop.catholic.com. Friends, I hope you have a blessed 13th Sunday of Ordinary Time here at B. Until next time, God bless.
Thank you for listening to the Sunday Catholic Word. Find more great shows by visiting CatholicAnswersPodcasts.com or just search for Catholic Answers wherever you listen to podcasts.